Awesome. Welcome everybody back to the podcast. I am Brandon Bagg and I'm sitting here with Masai Day. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
I have been really excited to have you on because I think a couple weeks ago we were chatting about the arts community in Vancouver and its sort of lack of intersectionality. Here, I'll cheese her real quick.
Cheers.
So I know you from your role as the violinist for Little Fox. You played at Guild.
Yes.
Just saw you play at the Sylvia the other day with Allison. I also know you from the acting world because we both went to Studio 58.
Separate times.
Yeah. Separate times. And you was 2 years ago. You workshopped it like before COVID. And then I think last year, you did your show that you co-wrote.
Yeah, Mozart and Your Brother. Yeah.
And one of the things I really love about that show is it's a cross section between the musical community and the acting community, the theater community, in a way that most like musical theater obviously does that.
Yeah.
But there aren't a lot of artists that I encounter in Vancouver that sort of bridge both worlds as, doing the gigging thing as a musician, but also doing the acting thing.
Yeah.
Is that something that you find as well?
It's a very specific niche of actor that likes to do and there's a few shows out there geared towards those people. Like Once is one of those shows, which is based on that fantastic Irish movie. Mm-hmm. They're kind of a bit of a rare breed. And specifically, I come from classical music, and I think there's even less of a theater classical music crossover.
Yeah, totally. you studied at in Victoria, right?
I did, yeah.
Yeah.
UVic.
Have you grown up playing the violin all your life? Or?
Most of it, yeah, since I was almost seven.
Violin. What was the draw for violin?
My mom plays. Her mother really loved violin, but never got to learn it. So she made all her kids take it. And my mom was the only one that kept up with it. And so my mom had one. So I was curious about that. And then I think what happened was my best friend started taking lessons and then I really wanted them. And then she ended up quitting and I kept it forever.
Yeah. Did you play in like all through high school and stuff?
Yeah.
I feel like high school bands don't really have like a, you don't really think of the violin when you think of the high school band. You think of like the sax and the trombone is like the two instruments that dominate high school bands.
Yeah. and I had a kind of funny high school experience because I homeschooled between halfway through first grade until grade 10, 11-ish. And then I went to high school and I did this funny program where you got credit for your extracurricular stuff. So I was already playing in an orchestra and stuff. So got credit for my violin lessons and did half days at high school, which was pretty cool. But I was kind of an awkward.
Did you grow up out here?
Here in Vancouver.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how did, when did the acting bug come in?
The acting bug kind of started originally when I was like around 12, when I was homeschooling. Yeah, yeah. The homeschooling community in Vancouver, I mean, when I was growing up, I'm not involved with it anymore, but it probably still is really great and integrated. And the moms were really great about organizing different activities for us. And one of the things that they organized was Shakespeare classes with Bart on the Beach actors, kind of like their young Shakespeareans programs.
Yeah.
So that's where it originally came from. And then I left it behind to focus on violin. And then it just kind of started coming back.
And where did you studied music in Victoria. What school were you at?
UVic.
You were at UVic. That's what I thought.
At the School of Music.
That was before studio or after studio?
That was before studio. So I did that right after high school.
Did you 4-year program?
Yep.
So you went 4-year program studying classical
music.
Bachelor music. And then was that right into theater school after that or? It's a lot of education.
Yeah, I know. It wasn't right into theater school full time. I took some classes at a school that doesn't exist anymore called Tuba Physical Theater Center.
Cool.
Which was actually right in this neighborhood. It was in the Dominion building upstairs from Nuba, where Nuba mm-hmm. is now. And so I did some classes there just sort of to improve me as a performer, and then mm-hmm. sort of found them more interesting and ended up getting a musician job at Bard on the Beach in an onstage string trio for The Tempest.
Yeah.
In, I think that was 2008. And that kind of gave me the theater bug in a more serious way. And then I decided to actually go to theater school properly.
Yeah. Circling back to the show that we mentioned earlier, Mozart and Her Brother. Mm-hmm. Was that always a sort of a passion for you, that story?
I mean, it's as a kid being involved in classical music, the story of the Mozart siblings was always a really interesting story because they were such talented kids. And then outside of classical music, not many people know that there was two of them.
Yeah. And it's kind of one of those, it's almost one of those sad, I don't want to say mysteries, but like, it's like Alexandria, like, you know, the lost library of Alexandria, right? Because nothing it survives of her work.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's she was the older sibling, and they toured for, I mean, you could probably speak to it a little bit better than I can, because most of what I know from seeing your show and then subsequent reading afterwards. I mean, that's really interesting.
Oh, that's cool.
But for those, I don't know if you want to give a little recap of the show.
I'll
just butcher it.
So it is based on the story of Maria Anna Mozart, who was known as Nannerl to her family, and her little brother Wolfgang. And their father, Leopold, discovered that they were really talented and started managing them, touring all over the courts of Europe from a very young age. I can't remember exactly what age they were when they started touring, but I think maybe Wolfgang was 6 and Nannerl was maybe 11 or 12 mm-hmm. all over Europe until Nannerl got to be in her late teens. And then Leopold decided she needed to stay home and become a woman and not have a career because that was not appropriate. Yeah. So that's kind of this. The play is actually a lot of fun. There's lots of goofy, silly stuff that happens between the kids and some other fun, kooky characters that come in. And then.
Yeah, because it's just the two of you. So you're both playing a plethora of characters.
Yes. So we play the kids and the parents and then, some other outsiders royalty who give some, their perspective, some royalty, some doctors, some audience members, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Were you always drawn to classical music growing up, or is it something that you kind of gravitated towards?
I guess later. I was. I really loved Tchaikovsky when I was little, maybe because my grandmother took me to the Nutcracker from a really young age.
So help me out here, because I don't know if this rumor is true, but I heard that Tchaikovsky hated the Nutcracker.
I have also heard that.
Is there any...
I think it's probably, I mean, I haven't researched it in depth or anything, but that sounds likely to me, given that it was a thing.
It was like his stairway.
Like he wrote it. It's like he wrote a Hallmark Christmas movie and that's everybody's memory of him.
That's what
he also wrote War and Peace, but everybody just thinks about the Hallmark Christmas movie.
That would piss me off too. How did the show come about? What was the vision to creation?
Because
you co-wrote it with the writer.
Our main writer was Mark Weatherly, and Mark and I worked on a show in Shemanis on Vancouver Island in Once, actually, which is the musical I mentioned earlier.
Cool! I love that. I've only ever seen the film. I've never seen it live.
Cool!
I love the music so much. It's such a beautiful show.
Yeah, it was really, really fun. We had a great cast. The music was really great. Our cast was, I think, especially musically strong. So, really fun to play with them all. And then on closing, Mark and I were kind of talking about, oh, what's next for you, as people do on closing nights of shows. And Mark mentioned that he writes plays and he wasn't sure what he wanted to write next. And I said, well, I have this idea I've been sitting on and I'm just not writing it. And it's about Mozart's sister. And Mark said, oh, okay, I'll write that for you. Send me your notes after a few drinks on closing night. Yeah. And then I emailed him when we got home and said, hey, do you want to actually do this? And he said, okay, sure. Yeah. And so I sent him my research, sent him my story ideas, and he said, let's do this one, and just ran with it. Yeah.
What was it like arranging that show? Because the music in it, it's not like it's most, you've like moved, you've arranged classical tunes to fit the show, but you've added some of the, I think there's lyrics that are added into some.
Yes.
So what was it like that, I mean, because you're arranging Mozart to fit into a show, that's got to feel, you got to feel a bit of a weight
sure.
when you're dealing with that. Like, what does that feel like?
Yeah, I mean, yes, sometimes I did have some moments of like, who am I to be doing this with this stuff? But yeah. Also, I really, really love doing it. It's really fun mucking around with classical music and doing stuff to it for me. So I had a lot of fun with it. I had fun. I got to make up the lyrics for those moments when we had we have the Papageno Papagina duet from the Magic Flute in there that I wrote a bunch of silly lyrics for, and it's just really fun. Mm-hmm. That totally feeds my inner music nerd, getting to do stuff like that.
Do you have any plans on putting it up again? Because I think it was last year you did it at, forgive me, I forget the name of the theater. I went and saw it.
Yeah, we did it three places. Actually, we did it first at the Anvil Center in New West, and then the ATC Arts Center in Maple Ridge, and the Evergreen Cultural Center in Coquitlam.
Cool. Mm-hmm. Coming again?
Hopefully. We have some irons in the fire for that, but we're kind of on pause because our other actor is having a baby in the spring.
Oh, congratulations.
So, yeah. Kind of difficult to be playing a six-year-old boy when you're pregnant. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Fair yeah. Enough. Was being in the realm of, because like I mentioned, we both went through Studio 58 different times. And I remember when I was looking at theater schools, I was specifically looking at theater schools that did not have musical theater programs, because I knew I didn't want to do musical theater. I love musical theater, not what I wanted to do.
Fair.
I got two left feet and I'm not much of a singer. So I'm like, I would rather be at a school that doesn't do musical theater. And then I think they ended up doing like three or four musicals while I was there.
I think they've been doing more and more musicals.
Which was fine. I had, you know, whatever. It was what it was. But did you always have designs on doing some sort of musical theater? And do you classify Mozart and her brother as musical theater?
I guess technically it is musical theater, but it's not really what people think of as musical theater when you have that image of musical
similar
theater
to Once.
In your head. Yeah.
It's like, you know, it's one thing I loved about Once is the music. Like, it's important to the story, but it doesn't necessarily drive the plot. You know, it's the artist. I feel like that's what, like, you think about a show, like, I don't know, The Last 5 Years or Grease or Wicked or you know, the music is part of the story,
right?
Yeah. So what was my original question?
If Mozart was musical theater,
something that he always wanted to get into?
I never really had it as a goal to get into traditional musical theater where I would be, I don't know, in Wicked or something like that. Cause singing's always, I've been in choirs and stuff since I was a kid, but I've never really focused on that in the same way. So I had heard great things about Studio 58. I knew it was one of the top schools in Vancouver, so I had my eye on it in that way, but I wasn't really looking specifically or not for musical theater, just for the best acting training program I could get into.
Yeah. Your role in Little Fox.
Yes.
You obviously play the violin, do some vocals. I guess what you classify Little Fox as, like, indie folk. Is that fair?
Yeah. Indie folk blues singer songwriter.
Yeah. Cause there's some blues in there as well.
Yeah.
And how do you, what was it like coming into, what's it like coming into like more modern genres as a classically played violin player? And when does the violin become the fiddle?
That's a great question. I don't totally know the answer because they're the same instrument and that's just in how you play them. Little Fox has been really fun. Allison Jenkins, our lead artist, writes all the songs and she likes to fold all these different styles into it, which is really fun. I really like her writing. And the nice thing about classical training is it gives you really good chops to take into whatever style you want to be playing. And then the challenge becomes, I think when I first started, this was before Little Fox, but when I first started to have to pick up other styles for theater and stuff, I tended to play too cleanly in a way. Mm-hmm. So you have to kind of start getting comfortable with being less perfectly on the beat or like smudging the intonation a little bit and making some crunchy sounds, making which can just a little
bend
and grittier sometimes, which is really fun when you start figuring out how it works and stuff.
Have you moved, much into the realm of fiddling?
Mostly because I've got jobs in theater that have wanted me to do that. Yeah. So like for once I had to learn some fiddle tunes for that. Really fun. Some of them were Irish, some of them were Czech, which was very cool.
Neat. I love
all these Czech characters that are in the live version more so than in the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love, there's that classic, like you hear, you think Czech or even Russian violin, like obviously the Fiddler on the Roof, right? It's one of the most famous musicals of all time.
Yes.
There's a distinctive sound to that part of the part, like you can hear it in your head. You're like that type of violin.
Yeah.
It's one of the things I love so much about that instrument is, again, like you just said it, it's the exact same instrument, but you play it two different ways and it's called two different things. Yeah. I don't know any other instrument that does that.
That has a different name. I feel like other instruments have nicknames. I'm trying to think of an example, but
I mean, I can think of like guitar.
People call it their axe.
Their axe, yeah. And if someone,
which isn't quite the same thing.
I think if someone's going to call it an axe, it's probably like pretty obvious that they're playing like, I don't know, metal or
right.
Metal,
they're probably not
metal adjacent,
flamenco or classical guitar.
But even that's got a classical guitar. It's a different type of guitar. It's like, so you've got classical guitar, you got an acoustic, you got a acoustic steel string, you got a steel guitar. All these different kind of guitars are for these different types of music.
Yeah.
Which, correct me if I'm wrong, because I don't know, but I'm fairly certain that, like, you know, that Czech style or, you know, Eastern European or Russian style violin is using the same instrument as the guy playing for Chris Stapleton.
I think it mostly is. I know there, I found out, I got to try this summer, actually. I spent the summer in Ontario doing this other really fun theater job where I also did a bunch of fiddling, but I got to go to the Goderich Celtic Festival and there was a violin maker there who had these really interesting violins that had a second set of strings underneath the fingerboard just for resonating.
Weird.
Yeah. Which I
think. Did you get to play it?
I did. Yeah. He let me play it. It was really, really cool.
Is that like almost like a 12 string guitar? Like,
I mean, something it would like have that? Eight strings, but I think with a 12-string guitar, although I haven't played them, octaves. You're still playing all the strings, right?
Yeah, you
right?
still play all the strings. This one, you're not.
With this one, you're not. They're just under there. And so when you play in certain keys that resonate with those strings, it just gives, like, you have a built-in reverb on your
that's
sound.
That's super cool. And it's just an acoustic instrument.
Yeah.
That's really neat.
And I think that's maybe called a hardanger fiddle, which I think is a more Scandinavian thing, but I'm just really.
And what's a viola?
A viola is very much like a violin, but it is a fifth lower and a bit bigger.
Right. So it's just, yeah, exactly what you said. It's a little bit lower, a little bit bigger.
Yeah. Yeah. Still has the four strings.
What's how? What's it like? And there are two. It's E A D F, right?
On a violin, like yeah. Or sorry, G D A and E.
G D A and E. It's like a bass guitar, but it's
backwards.
Backwards.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I forgot what I was going to say. You mentioned your show. I'm glad you mentioned your show. That you just did in Ontario.
Oh, yes.
Because I want to ask you about that. Because it was you, it was in Blythe, right?
Yes.
And you guys did three shows.
Yes.
Which you had to rehearse for all at once and then launch all at once.
Almost. So we had a 5-week rehearsal period before we opened the first one. So it was three plays. All around the same story of this family, the Donnellys. So based on, well, I mean,
Were they new plays or?
No, they were written by James Rainey in the 70s.
Okay.
And our director, Gil Garrett, adapted them and shortened them a little bit because they were really long. But they're Canadian classics that I somehow didn't know about until I got this job.
Yeah, yeah.
And then half the people I told about it, mostly from out here, said, oh, yeah, what's that? And then the other half were like, that's a Canadian classic. That's so exciting. And the story is from Ontario of this Irish immigrant family that came into conflict with their community in various complicated ways. And a mob of between 20 and 40 of their neighbors came to their house in the middle of the night. In the winter one night and killed some of them and burned their house down.
Just so, a warm, nice warm topic for a summer just, play.
You know.
So all three families, it's like a trilogy.
Yeah, it's a trilogy about how the family immigrated to Canada and the kids were born and they grew up and this conflict developed maybe partially through conflicts that got brought over from Ireland and partially religious things, partially stuff that grew while they were there because of the specific people that they were moving in next to. Anyway, yeah.
They were running simultaneously?
Eventually, yeah. So, right. So we had 5 weeks rehearsing the first one. So the first week we kind of did table work on all three shows where we just sat down and went through all the scripts and got a sense of the whole story, just sitting around and talking about it. And then we rehearsed the first play and then we started performing the first play while we started rehearsing the second play. So then we had, I think it was about 3 weeks and then we opened the second play and then we were performing one and two while we rehearsed number three. And then by the first weekend of August, we had all three up and then we were just running all three all at once.
So the idea was that like at any point during the run, you could still see the whole series, right? If you hadn't seen the first one early enough, you weren't going to miss your chance to see the first one.
No, yeah, you could keep seeing the first one, but you couldn't see the third one until August.
Until August.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That must have been a lot of work.
It was, but it was really fun.
And how many it was a like an ensemble cast.
Mm-hmm.
How many were you?
10 altogether.
10 altogether.
10 actors.
So were you jumping around different parts? How many parts did you play?
Yes. Oh, I counted that at some point. At some point backstage, we were all talking about who has the most characters. And I think so I had like 18 or 19, yeah. And I didn't even win the who has most characters competition.
And you mentioned you were playing violin for this show as well.
Yeah. 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 That's why they brought me out there, because of the violin chops.
Because you got
the cool thing about the violin chops. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Sometimes I get to go cool places.
Has the violin landed you in anything for film as well?
Not yet. I think it would be cool if that could happen. I just need some Hallmark Christmas movie to have a violin playing character.
They're out there. They're out
something.
There. I watched your demo reel today.
Oh, cool.
And is it mismatched?
Yes.
Yeah.
Not a Christmas movie, but the other Hallmark wedding fascination.
Yeah, so it was a Hallmark wedding and Christmas, right?
Yeah, I think that's their favorite thing.
It's also half of the industry in Vancouver. it's like just get ready because that's what's going to get you work.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you had some other fun ones on there. You were on Supernatural, I think.
I was, too. Yeah.
Because that show, that was running for, that ran for what, 16 seasons or something ridiculous?
I think it was like that, 16.
Was it fun to be on set for that?
It was really fun, yeah. It was a very friendly set. Mm-hmm. I had a great experience. One of the brothers was directing the episode.
Right, because I always find that funny when you get those long standing those shows that run for so long, eventually they just start letting the cast direct
them. They just start directing it. Yeah.
It's just like, oh, this one directed by this guy. How long is that show been going? Like 14 years. Yeah.
But yeah, everybody was really great. I had a good time on that.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Got to do lots of screaming and running away.
So this, the Blythe gig, is that something that, are you going to find yourself with that company again in subsequent years doing 18 roles? Is it something you're looking for?
You never know. That's the thing with theater, is you just never know.
Yeah.
I would love to go back there sometime, but needs to be the right slot for that to happen. I had a good time. It was a long time being away from home, but I had a really,
was
really
a 3 month
summer over
contract?
There. It was four.
Four.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, it's kind of like, 4 months of not working a Joe job.
Yes. 4 months of getting to be an artist full time.
Yeah.
I'll drink to that. Wonderful experience to have. Yes.
Cheers. Do you have any other writing projects you're working on?
Yeah. I started writing a play during the summer while I was being an artist full time.
Awesome.
Because one of my cast buddies told me about this Banff, it was a new program that had just been announced at Banff for theater creation, and you needed at least 20 pages of a script to apply, and they were looking for interdisciplinary pieces that incorporated different things. So my friend said, hey, you should submit your Mozart project to this. And I thought about it, and our Mozart project is really pretty much developed at this point, so we didn't think it was the right thing to submit. But I had this other play idea that I'd been kind of floating around in my head, and so I decided to see if I could write 20 pages of it by the deadline. And
did you get it in?
I got it submitted. I didn't get into the program, but getting myself to sit down and write is a challenging thing. And the fact that I sat down and wrote 20 pages felt really good.
Yeah, I tip of the hat. I struggle with it so much. I've got probably I would say conservatively half a dozen, like 30-page scripts.
Okay.
That are 30 pages of the full of both, like, I've gotten 30 to 30 pages and then go, I don't know where to go.
Now what do I do? Right.
Because it's a struggle too. Because I actually took a little writing course recently. And I remember them telling me one of the things, he was like, you have to have, like, if you just write because you got like a small, like a little idea of like a scene or a character, but you don't know where the whole story's going.
Right.
You're just going to get to that 30 page mark. And it resonated so much with me because that's where all of them go. I'll be like, have this cool concept in my head, and then I get to the 30 pages mark or whatever it is, and I'll realize that the cool concept I had in my head was just the scene or a character.
Right.
When you're approaching those writing projects, do you approach it from a big picture kind of place, or is it sort of drive the car and see where it goes?
Well, I mean, this project I am basing on the life of an actual person. So that kind of helps with the big picture and the structure. But yeah, I think that's definitely a challenge, is figuring out where to start and where the beginning, middle, and end is going to be. And when I started thinking about applying for this Banff Center program, I was having trouble sleeping one night and I decided to just get my laptop out and see if I could block out a story structure for this idea that I had in my head.
You're not,
because I was like, I didn't know where to start. So, and I had been talking to another actor, writer, artist friend who had suggested that that was a good way to like to come up with your whole story structure, and then that will help you figure out where you need to go.
Yeah, yeah.
So I decided to just, since I was awake, sit down and try to do that. So I did.
Map the whole thing?
Map the whole, like, this is what could be the beginning, middle, and end of this story. This is where it could go. And I sent it to my friend the next morning and said, hey, do you think there's anything here? And she said, yes, there definitely could be something there. You should keep going with it.
I think it's important, too, to have, I struggle with that, of having someone to bounce your work off of.
Yeah.
And for me, it's not because I'm precious with it. I'm actually really good at being, when someone's like, this is shit, take this out, or this is, you know, this didn't make sense to me. I'm not great at it. Like, I'm a little
it's never the
I'm
easiest thing. Precious, you're like, you love this scene. And someone's like, no, you don't need you that don't scene. Need but it. I love it.
But
that it
was like, but it's like, yeah, I get it. It's clever. Yeah. But the dialogue is really funny here. It's not that funny because it doesn't make sense to the story. I'm like, okay. My problem is it's hard for me to like bring something to somebody because I'm like, God, they don't want to read it. I feel like I'm like
imposing.
I feel like I'm imposing. Yeah. And it's I never get to that. It's really hard for me to bring something to someone and be like, just give me the gears with it. But
or I feel like if I tell anybody that I'm working on something,
then I have to finish it.
Then they're gonna ask me about it. So I mean, but conversely, when I started to think that I was actually going to start writing this and apply for the thing, then I started telling people in my cast about it.
Yeah, because if you put it out in the universe, then you have to finish it. Yeah, that's how I was with the cigarettes. Every time I would quit smoking, I would not want to tell anybody because I was like, if I tell anybody, then I actually have to fucking quit.
Yeah.
So you throw it out there and then you have to do it. You mentioned when you were in Blythe this summer.
Yes.
Getting to work as an artist for 4 months, which is obviously the dream for anyone that's in the arts, right?
You know, you get to work as an artist
all the
time.
You get paid to play music. You get paid to write. Or you get paid to act. You get paid to do whatever it is that you're passionate about.
Yeah.
What's it like for you being like a multidisciplinarian artist? I don't even know if that's a thing. living and working in a city like Vancouver, juggling, you know, what you need, the Joe job to pay the bills, but also finding the time to like pursue the stuff that makes you happy.
Yeah, it's a juggling act or a balancing act or something like that all the time. I think being a multidisciplinary artist helps in a way because when we started Little Fox, or when Allison really started it, Allison got really into songwriting over the pandemic. So it kind of sparked her creativity. And I know some people feel like it like killed their artistic life, but somehow for her, she found a way to make it really feed her artistic life. So she had a ton of songs. And then when bars started opening up and music venues started opening up again, and we did our first gig as a full band at Guild & Company, actually. And I realized how much I had missed live performing over the time that wasn't a thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was crazy being in a room with tons of people again and a little bit nerve-wracking, but also really, really, really satisfying. So having Little Fox has been just like another wonderful way to be able to perform and explore a different side of my musical skills that I hadn't got to as much before because I hadn't really been part of a band in the same way over an extended period of time. So yeah.
First rock and roll band.
Yeah, totally. But yeah, it's having that in addition to working on mm-hmm. the theater and the TV and commercial auditions and whatever has been just a great other creative
outlet. Yeah, yeah.
Outlet, creative feed. Yeah.
You mentioned Allison, who's great, and she writes beautiful music. I have to agree with you there. And Little Fox, where can people find Little Fox? All the Audifies and
all the things. Bandcamp. I think she's on Spotify too. I think she's definitely. There's some stuff on YouTube. There's some videos, some live videos of I think at least one of our shows at Gilt. OneLittleFox.com is the website cool. for the band.
You mentioned that she was one of those artists who was able to maybe expand or at least live their creativity through the pandemic. I felt very much I was one of those ones who I got zapped.
Yeah.
Right. I was very much like, you know, a year in, I was like, I don't even know who the fuck I am anymore. Like, where do you felt like you feel like you fit in with that on that? That scale.
I had been gearing up to make Mozart and her brother happen. So in January 2020, we did a week-long workshop of the script for Mozart and her brother. We worked on it for a week, and then we did a little staged reading, and we were really excited about it, and we were ready to figure out how to get it into production, and then the pandemic happened.
Right. Because you did a workshop, right? Right before the pandemic?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So that was, and I was kind of ready for 2020 to be the year where I really dug into my artistic life and make things happen. And then it just didn't. So that was kind of soul crushing for a while. And then my creativity became making a giant quilt.
For a while. I mean, you guys got the show off the ground, which is,
we did. We managed, we had some little moments of arguing about the script over the course of the 2 years that we couldn't do anything else other than just look at the script. But then, we managed to get it off the ground.
And you did say that it's coming again, right?
I hope so.
Coming again?
We have plans to make that happen.
Yeah.
At an undefined moment as of yet.
Were you always drawn, when you were first drawn to the story of Mozart and her brother, or the Mozart siblings, was it from the perspective, because you said it was something that was, a lot of people were drawn to when you were in school, that story.
Yeah, I mean, among kids taking classical music lessons, you learn about their kids that were really great at classical music.
Were you drawn to it more because it was a story about siblings, or is a story about unrealized talent, or the side of it, like a woman's unrealized talent.
I think all of that, really. All of the above. Yeah. There's not a lot of well-known women in the history of classical music.
Yeah.
They were given very much less opportunities than men were. Mm-hmm. My mom definitely was good about finding books and stuff about the women that there were in the history of music. Yeah. And I was always curious to learn about them. And
other icons for you that you would consider writing a show about?
I mean, maybe.
Other than the one you're currently working on?
there are some really interesting women out there. I mean, you could probably write a story about Clara Schumann. Clara Schumann's husband, Robert, was the much better known composer. Right. There's a story that Brahms was also in love with her. Mm-hmm. Clara was a better pianist than Robert was.
Were they like the Shelleys of classical music?
Maybe. But I think there's also a story that he damaged his hands because he was trying to stretch them so he could reach bigger intervals on the piano. Anyway. But yeah, he wasn't as good at piano as she was.
Yeah.
She was a piano rock star of her era in Europe. And she did write music, and her music survived. Like, there's I was playing in a string quartet for fun, which sort of petered out when the pandemic happened. But we played one of her string quartets.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is classical music something that you'd like, do you put it on at home? Is it?
I do sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not all the time.
Not all the time.
Sometimes. I live with someone who likes to put on music a lot. So
right.
Mostly he puts on music.
Really, that guy?
Yeah, that guy. he has good musical taste too. I enjoy his music choices.
Yeah, yeah. I like it when he brings the tape deck to the to anywhere. Hang out at the park. He's got the tape deck. It's like, yes.
Yes. he actually, when I was living in Blythe shout out to Garrett Quirk. When I was in Blythe over the summer, he mailed me a tape player. And over the course of the summer, he mailed me, I think it was 12 mixtapes. And Sage Management kept bringing me these tiny packages. And they're like, you got another one.
yeah, that's, I'm Garrett's not cute.
Not at all, never.
So you mentioned the show that you're working on is, it's about a real person.
Yes.
Is that something that you, when you think about sitting down to write, is that, because obviously the other show that you worked on with Mark was Mozart, where it's obviously about a real person, mm-hmm. Or real persons. Is that a place that you gravitate towards when you think about, I want to write a show? Do you instantly pull from history or reality for inspiration, or is it just a coincidence?
I've always been very interested in historical stories and different eras and what it would have been like to be part of those eras. And also because I like these unconventional musicals where you get to have all of the actors also have instrumental skills and stuff. I think I've been poking around for existing stories that I could do that with. Mm-hmm. And I mean, so far, I think having an existing story to start with feels less overwhelming than having to come up with mm-hmm. everything from a blank canvas. So at least I have somewhere to start. So I like that.
Do you find, where do you, the line of artistic licensing, do you find it hard to navigate in terms of like when you're being, like when there's gaps in the story? And when you have to like, I gotta write a scene here.
Well, that's kind of what I'm struggling with the project I'm working on right now. I found out about this violinist who her name was, I think I've never heard anyone say it out loud, but she was American from Italian and Czech background. And her name was Gwila Bustabo. I might be saying that wrong.
Gwila Bustabo. Now we both said it wrong.
Bustabo.
So we're both in there.
And I found out about her while I was looking up a different violinist. And she was becoming famous in her early 20s when the Second World War happened. And her mom was kind of her overbearing parent manager, kind of like Leopold Mozart. And her mom decided that the best thing for her career would be to stay in Europe and continue to perform with all the very talented conductors in the Nazi-occupied areas of Europe. So then ended up on the wrong side of history, and they both got arrested at the end of the war by the American army for potential, both Gwila and her mother. For possible collaboration with the Nazis. And I believe they didn't actually get charged, but she was basically blacklisted and her career was never the same after that. And she had mental health struggles. And I found out about her story and it just has a lot of dramatic potential, I think.
I think there's
It's a lot of darkness in there and a lot of interesting places to go, but it's also really hard to find out specific details about her.
Totally. Because it's interesting that whole concept of post-World War II women being accused of collaborators. Tons of French women.
Right.
And there's a lot of like that. Obviously history is so nuanced because people are nuanced, but I'm excited to see what you do with it because there's a lot of meat there. Cause there were a lot of people that, you know, were in occupied German Nazi territory that wasn't Germany.
Yeah.
That later got accused of collaborating because they were just
trying to survive,
trying to stay alive in a really, really horrible situation.
Yeah.
They weren't obviously going through what the Jews were going through, but
no,
they knew that if they'd said anything, they would be. So it's like, it's a weird, really, really murky part of history. So you set yourself quite a task.
Yeah. I think it's a challenge. But I have started on it and I'm trying to find ways go forward with it and how to handle that. So like she chose to be there, or her mother chose for her to be. It's not
they could have left.
They could have left. So they could have gone back to the States.
Maybe they were collaborators.
Yeah. Or maybe they just were like, oh, it's just art. It's not about politics. Yeah. We just want to keep taking these jobs and everybody else is not taking these jobs. So we're going to take them. But how much can you keep doing that and ignoring the horrible stuff that's happening around you? Because there's no way they could have been living in all of those places and been completely unaware of what was going on.
Yeah. That's crazy.
Yeah.
And in Germany, the last one took place in Germany too. The last play.
I mean, it took place in Germany and all over. They got to London, they got to Paris, they got,
So specifically these two, I forgot the name already. Guila.
I'm guessing Guila.
Did they end up back in the U.S.?
Eventually, yeah.
But it completely killed her career.
Obviously. American orchestras wouldn't have her as a soloist. She taught...
Which is fine because the American government was fine to accept Nazi scientists.
And it's also, I'm not sure where they drew the line because other artists who worked with the Nazis later managed to have productive careers and get hired by American BMWs orchestras. So why was it harder for her than it was for German conductors who later...
Or she was a woman.
Yeah, she was a woman. And there were and it wasn't like every man who was accused of being a collaborator had a fine career afterwards. Like there was a conductor who committed suicide because he was banned from performing because of his Nazi collaborator record. So in his home country, he was banned from performing and
So is there is there something, did you learn about her in school or did you stumble upon her?
I stumbled on her on the internet. An article called The Forgotten Violinist, and I thought that sounded interesting.
What type of music was she playing? Classical. She was from the United States?
From Wisconsin.
What other composers was she? Who else was over there at the time?
She played, apparently she played the Sibelius Concerto for Sibelius, and Sibelius really enjoyed her interpretation of it. So there was this other composer called Ermanno Wolf Ferrari, who had a pretty cool name, who was half German and half Italian, who wrote a concerto for her. And he was much older, but he may have had romantic feelings for her. We don't know. There's a bunch of letters between them in a library in Munich that I can't read.
Oh, really?
Because she only died in 2002. And German copyright law is got stricter. And so now nobody can read them until I think it's 70 years after she died, unless maybe I find out who has her copyright now, but I don't know who that anyway.
So they're just, you can't read them as in you're not allowed to read them. Not,
nobody
you can't read them
is allowed to read them.
Crazy.
Maybe if
and they're just
we
sitting...
found out who inherited her copyright, maybe I could get permission. But
that's
yeah, they're in a library in Munich. You could read them a few years ago. I've had this lovely email correspondence with a conductor in Germany who did read them for research for a recording that he did. But yeah, now you can't read them.
Oh, wow. You could write a whole show about that.
I mean,
like
yeah.
just reading the letters.
It's getting to be quite
it's like,
the
sounds like
investigation.
A Dan Brown novel.
Yeah. what other composers she would have? I mean, she would have played all the classical, big concerto repertoire of Beethoven and Brahms and Mendelssohn. Mendelssohn would have been banned in Nazi Germany because he was a Jewish composer.
Yeah.
But she was known that I think that was one of her big debut pieces in New York when she was a teenager was the Mendelssohn with at Carnegie Hall, I think, or something. But yeah, so she would have played all of that fabulous repertoire, and Paganini.
Yeah.
And
so circle back to just in light of that, I want to kind of re-ask a question about where you go for artistic licensing when you're trying to write a show about someone like that. And you're sitting on a, you know, this treasure trove of information in these letters exists and you can't access it. Is that something that like, do you sort of expunge that completely from your exploration of narrative, or is it something that you can't look away and you have to like somehow rope it in? Or
I'm still trying to figure out how to get permission to read them.
Right. So you haven't. Yeah.
I haven't given up on it yet.
How do you even go about looking into that? Like,
So if she had had children, I would contact her children and see if they. Because they would have inherited her copyright, but I don't think she did. I couldn't find out anywhere from my research so far that she had children. She had a brother, and it doesn't look like he had children either.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to... I know she lived in a YWCA in Birmingham, Alabama, towards the end of her life. So I tried emailing them to see if they might know who... would have been in charge of her estate, but I haven't heard back from them yet.
Yeah.
The conductor I was emailing with gave me an address of a doctor in Germany who apparently collects documents about Gwila Bustabo and met her when he was very young. And I sent him a snail mail letter, but it just came back today.
Today?
Unknown,
that's such a bummer.
Insufficient address. So, a friend was helping me look him up online, and we maybe found a clinic that he works at, and I maybe found an email address for that clinic.
Nice. So what's the composer that you've been emailing back and forth with?
The conductor?
The conductor. Mm-hmm. Sorry, yeah, that's read them. Mm-hmm. Were they able to tell you much about the context of them? Because like, what happens if you read them and you're like, oh gosh, she was a Nazi?
Then that is an interesting play also. I didn't ask him a whole lot about them. It's not like he read them yesterday and he can be like, this is everything that was in the letters either. I watched an interview he did on YouTube that I found through the liner notes for the recording he did of this concerto that was dedicated to Gwila. And the letters were mentioned in there. So that was how I knew that,
that
he'd read the letters and they had been readable at some point.
And you said she died in 2002?
Yes.
I mean, you could just wait till 2072.
Yeah, if I'm still around in 2072, maybe everything will have exploded by then.
Yeah,
who knows?
Or they've figured out a way to make us live forever. That's what I'm pulling for.
Or that. Who knows?
Yeah.
Could go either way. 2072.
So if you If you can't find, if you can't read the letters,
then I just have to write the play around.
Yeah.
I'll just have to fill in more holes. They'd be a great resource.
Would you continue to seek them out? Like if you finished the play and got it through production, and then like a year later got access to would you continue to seek access to them? And
I would be curious.
Yeah. Would you let's say you like the play gets to production. And is it going to be like similar structure as to Mozart and Her Brother? Like,
it's too early to say at this point, I think.
Would you go back to the drawing board and change it if the letters revealed something else or something more?
Maybe. I mean, it's hard to know. When you're writing plays about people or movies about people, I feel like it's a pretty common thing for things to be slightly altered to help the shape of
or elevated
the movie or the create the myth of that story, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's hard to know that because it would depend what I found out. Like if I found out everything I'd made up in the play was a lie, then maybe I'd come back. I really like historical accuracy when I can have it.
Totally. Yeah.
If I can't find out a thing, then gotta use my creativity to fill in that gap. But if I found out everything was completely wrong, then I might want to go back it would also depend on at what point in the life of the show I found out that.
Yeah, it sounds like you're like, forgive me if I'm wrong. It sounds like you're drawn to stories like the Mozart story of there's a lot we know X about a certain point of her life,
mm-hmm.
and then virtually nothing for the rest of it, like nothing after her brother died.
I mean, we know things about her life, but we don't know.
But we don't have music. Yeah. We don't know anything about her music.
Mm-hmm.
Similar with this violinist, we know some of her music has survived, obviously, and she.
There's recordings out there of her.
But then there's also this hole, I feel like with the Mozart story, the hole is being like we don't have any surviving copies of her compositions or her music, and this one being like these letters. Are you do you find yourself drawn to stories like that where there's like a missing puzzle piece almost that you've got to kind of like
I think
be
so.
Curious about when you're in the writing process?
Definitely, yeah.
Yeah.
Having that mystery makes it intriguing.
Yeah.
And the possibility to have the question answered. I mean, it's very unlikely we're going to run into a manuscript of Nannerl Mozart, but I know those letters are in a library in Munich.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
I know they're there.
Yeah. How many are they? Do you know?
I don't remember the exact number, but I think it's a lot. They wrote letters back and forth for a while before they met because she saw an opera that he wrote. And
yeah, and sorry, who did you say they were between?
Guila Bustabo, the violinist, and the composer Ermanno Wolf Ferrari.
Right, for Wolf Ferrari. How do you forget Wolf Ferrari?
It's a dramatic name.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, if you do decide to finish it, I greatly look forward to
I'm intending to finish it one way or another.
I look forward to that. And before we sign off, I'm gonna do
a little bit left. Yep.
Pour myself a tiny little bit so we can cheers. When can we see first of all, when can we see Little Fox again?
Oh. Well, the one that's in my head is Allison just emailed today. We're playing at Gilt on March 14th.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Awesome. Sweet.
So I know that.
So this will definitely be up before March 14th.
In the new year.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
Do you have any shows you're working on that you want to toss up into the ether?
Not yet.
Not yet.
Not yet.
Well, I look forward to seeing.
I will have at some point.
I look forward to seeing what you create.
Thank you.
Seeing Little Fox on March 14th.
Great.
Cheers.
Thanks so much. Cheers.